Thank you, Ron. My name is Keith Lewis. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
I'm really pleased to be here. Ron, when you were in Birmingham, did you steal anything out of a blue Buick? You may owe me an amends. I just thought I'd throw that out there. I'm just delighted to be here. I really am. I want to thank Diz and the committee for inviting me. It's such an honor to be invited to take part in anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was feeling really good till I got here. And now I feel like I shouldn't be here. I guess I should start off with the worst stuff first. I've only been married twice. I feel like such a loser, you know? They were right, I am inferior. I really am. And the only guy who makes me feel good is Mark. He's only been married once. And I was hoping George could help, but he's been married three times. So, with all the guys here put together, we couldn't equal the girls this weekend. If you don't know what I'm talking about, get the tapes. My sobriety date's May the 13th, 1973, and I'm a member of the Midtown group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Wilmington, North Carolina. And if you're ever in Wilmington, we meet Mondays and Thursdays at 7:00 in the evening. And please come. I can promise you, you're really going to be welcome there. I bring you greetings from my wife, Julia. I just talked to her a few minutes ago, and she prays the hour that I talk. And so she'll be in our little prayer room praying. And so does my buddy, Mike W., who does that too. I think they pray that I won't embarrass them or something. I don't know what it's about. It's really that you hear what you're supposed to hear and not what I say, because that's the way it works in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's really not what we say. It's what we need to hear. And if you're like me, I spent many, many years and the receiver was broken. I remember after I got sober and I started running around making amends to my brothers and sisters, I mean, we started talking about things, and I don't think they lived in the same house I lived in. I mean, they saw things entirely different. I remember, for example, the nuns. You know, the nuns, if you listen to people in AA, the nuns have been blamed for more stuff than the Nazis. And I remember saying to my brother, Denny, I said, remember the nuns? I said, well, you know, they beat your knuckles with the ruler. And it had to be worse for me, you know. So I said, you know, they used the centimeter side on my knuckles. You know, I always had to be worse than everybody else. And he said, well, I seem to remember that happening a couple times in 12 years. He said, but most of all, he said, I remember a bunch of dedicated women who gave their whole lives to teaching little kids like us. And I said, well, that's one way to look at it. Yeah. So it's as though I was never in the right house or something. I mean, Anna was talking about perception, and that's exactly what it was. My perception was always way, way off. It's so good to see some, I met some really neat new friends, and it's really good to see some old friends, Elmer and Tommy and Nate and my friend Laurel, I've known Laurel longer than anybody in this room. I was able to watch Laurel begin, and she doesn't know this, but I hope I can tell this, but I was thinking about it on the way from the airport, but when I first met Laurel, they were tying her down in Fourth Point Restraints in a psychiatric hospital, and I used to run around there at night, and one night they had her tied down and knocked out, and I went in and prayed for it, because I knew that she had that thing that if she ever got a hold of this, she'd run with it, and she has. The miracle happened in her life, and I've just always been thrilled watching Laurel and people like her. I never get tired of seeing that happen. Just never get tired of seeing it happen. And every time that it happens, I'm amazed again. And that's how I know it's happening for me, because I get to see it happen for others. That was 19 years ago. And she's been sober ever since and has touched a lot of lives. And that's what this thing's really about. And I was born in a small town in Ohio, a place called Martin's Ferry. I always say if you hadn't been there, I wouldn't bother. But then I've seen some towns in Georgia, and maybe it would be a step up. I don't know. But, I'm the eldest son and the second child in a family of 11 children. I'm Irish. I won't tell you what church I went to. I'll let you guess. It has something to do with bingo. I'm not going to say any more than that. But you know, it's been described so well. Mark did such a nice job of describing it, and Annie this morning, and Angie talked about, there was one theme that seemed to run through all three of those really fine talks, and that's the theme of fear. And the book tells us there are 100 forms of fear, and it's always self-centered fear, like what's going to happen to me, and that sort of thing. And that's what I lived with. And you don't know what it is till it's gone. And I've never been in Al-Anon. I go to a lot of Al-Anon meetings. My sponsor, when I was sober a year, sent me to Al-Anon. And he told me, he said, don't tell them you're an alcoholic. He said, they're up to here with alcoholics. He said, just go there and pass and listen. And because he said, you don't know anything about getting along with anybody. And that was the truth. But I know I'm an alcoholic because when I drank the first time, it changed for me. The fear was gone. It was an amazing. I mean, I was facing probably the most frightening thing I'd ever been involved in my life. Was the day I joined the Marine Corps. And that night I drank. And I was fearless. And that's how I know I'm an alcoholic. And the reason I know I'm an alcoholic is because alcohol really worked for me. But before I found alcohol, I had to live with that terror all the time. And I never knew what it was. And I thought everybody felt that way. And I couldn't understand how people were seemed to be functioning so well. It's like they didn't understand how serious it was. You know, for example, I was 4 years old and I had something lived under my bed. And I knew it was there. And I could put my ear against a mattress at night and I could hear it moving around down there. And I intuitively knew what it was there for. It was just waiting for me to dangle my little legs over the side of the bed and I was history. I just knew that. And other people walked around like it wasn't important. I never understood that. I wanted to say to my brother, Dumb Denny, hey, we got a crisis in this room. You know, Den never knew, you know, he just never understood. He just never made it. Oh, Dumb Denny. And, I remember, Denny was the first, I ought to tell you about Denny. Denny was the first guy I ever drank with. I was 5 and Denny was 4. We were at home. We didn't go out a lot when we were 5 and 4. And my mom was out and my dad was watching us. Mom was at the bingo or having a baby or doing something. And I guess Dad thought it'd be kind of cute and he gave us each a beer. And I never forget that night, you know, nothing happened to me, but old Denny slid out of the chair, and he was rolling around under the table, and he was singing Mary Had a Little Lamb and other drinking songs, and my dad kind of panicked, you know, and he wrestled him to the ground. He got his clothes off and put his jammies on him, you know, and he took him upstairs, and Denny was singing and having the best time, and I'll never forget this as long as I live. Dad said to me, son, get ready for bed. I said, okay, Dad, and I got ready, and he said, don't tell your mother about this, and I'll take you to the movies. Well, I was game, because, you know, they don't negotiate a lot with you when you're a kid, you know. But Den wasn't hearing it, man. He'd stand up laughing, you know, and I never forget as long as I live. Little Danny stood up, and he urinated on the floor. Yeah. And I remember thinking, you know, there's a kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. And, you know, he just never seemed to make it, you know. I mean, he grew up and did some strange things. I'll give you some examples. This is hard to believe, but Denny went to one college. Now, it gets worse. He graduated in 4 years. Yeah. Went to one graduate school. Graduated first in his class. Yeah, he got like 8 job offers. He took one. And a few years ago, he retired as a vice president in a large international corporation. And the strangest thing of all is he married one woman. You know? Now, here's a kid who had the world in the palm of his hands when he was 4 years old, and he just let it slip through his fingers, you know? You know, I had to work at this thing. I was 23 years old before I urinated on a bedroom floor for the first time. And I remember he was always my excuse. I mean, you know, if you'd have met me, I'd have told you. If you'd ever met me in a bar 27 or 28 years ago or something like that, I'd have told you that my problem was I grew up in poverty, you know. There were 11 of us, and we were real poor. And, you know, the violins would be going in the background. I mean, I could really, really drag it up. But then you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they don't put up with that stuff. I mean, I was telling the guy, said to me, he said, whatever happened to you anyway? And I said, well, I said, we were real poor and stuff, and never had a chance. And he said, don't you have a brother who was an officer in a large corporation? I said, well, yeah. And he said, where'd he live? I said, well, he lived with us. And he said, you hang around? Well, I said, well, actually, we slept in the same bed because there were a lot of us and we were real poor. He said, I figured out the problem. I said, what's that? He said, you slept on the wrong side of the bed. That's the problem. You know, and of course, I'd have been wrong. I grew up in a home with a mom and a dad who loved us very much. Now, it's true, we didn't have any excess material goods. You know, I had what was important, and that was a mother and a father who loved me very much. And every day that I would let her, my mother would hug me and kiss me and tell me she loved me. And she would do things that were just, I look back on it and just, you know, she was such a fine mother. I mean, she would leave things that other people would think ought to be done to spend time with her kids. Reading, and we read poetry, she read poetry to us every night. She made us all read for an hour every evening. It couldn't be homework. We had to read just for the love of reading. You know, we didn't have a television set, so we acted out Shakespearean plays in the living room. Here we are, these poor people in the coal fields of Ohio, you know, listening to the cranes in the mill next door, acting out Shakespearean plays in the living room. And she's just such a wonderful woman. She never finished high school, and she was a brilliant woman. She read a book a day. She slept like 3 hours a night. She was an incredible human being. Had a father who was very non-demonstrative. He couldn't say, I love you. He just showed it every way possible. He never owned an automobile until the last kid went to college. Every day I'd let him, he'd play ball with me or play checkers with me or do something with me. And I didn't know how wealthy I was because I had something called alcoholism. And alcoholism is a spiritual illness. And a spiritual illness is the inability to see the love which surrounds us. I had to be loved the way I wanted to be loved, or I wasn't loved at all. And that's sheer insanity. It's also immaturity. And my problem has always been immaturity. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous as a 29-year-old man. I was emotionally 15 years of age. And that was my problem. My problem was I had a reasonably mature body and an immature spirit and set of emotions. No one could have grown up better than I did. You know, we were taught to work. I went to work early as a kid, and things just couldn't have been better. I don't want to spend too much time talking about that business. There's one person I'd like to mention, though, and someone who's very, very dear to me, and that's a nun who taught me in high school, and her name was Sister Victoria. I always like to think, because Sister Victoria is one of the truly spiritual people I ever met. And when you're spiritually ill, I know now that spiritual people look silly. They really look silly. And Sister Victoria looked silly to me. She used to run around and say things like, every boy is a prince and every girl is a princess because we have a father who's a king. And so we'd run around behind her and call each other Prince Keith and Princess Mary, you know, and make fun of her and stuff. And she was a librarian, and I'll never forget, she'd walk around. I'd been back to my high school, and it's a little high school, and she had a library. It was a tiny little library with real old books, you know. And she walked around this place like it was a Library of Congress, because she had this odd belief that if you're in the middle of God's will, wherever you are is magnificent. And she'd walk around this little place like it was a Library of Congress. And when we served detention, which I did a lot, you know, I thought about that. You know, in a way, it was good that I was poor, because if we'd have been wealthy and we had a lot of money, I'd have been diagnosed as an acting out adolescent. We were poor, so I was just a punk. You know? And it was a real short diagnosis and real simple. Stop doing that. That was the medication I got for being a punk. Do that again, I'll break your head. Okay, nobody ever explained it that way before. Right, Mark? That's the way they explain it. But I'd have to, like, serve detention, and I'd do it with Sister Victoria, and she made you make rosary beads. That's what you had to do, you know. And rosary beads are things that Catholics pray on, you know. And there are 10 beads to a decade, and there are 5 decades. And so you get these pliers and this wire and these beads, and you know, and you start making these rosary beads. And she used to put me behind a magazine rack. She said I was a prince, but I was contagious, you know. And I would disrupt. I would dilly-dally, which was one of her great words, and I would disrupt the spiritual progress of other human beings. So she'd put me back there by myself, and I'd make these rosary beads, and I made them different. I put 11 beads in all the decades, and I did it for 4 years, and you know, and so there were like hundreds of mutant rosary beads, and they would send them all over the world to the different missions and everything, and she never said anything. I mean, you know, and you can't leave if they don't know. I mean, you know, I mean, if they didn't know, it'd be a waste of time. And so just before I graduated, I went and had a talk with her, and I said, you know what I've been doing the last 4 years? And she said, yes, I do, you sly little prince. She said, you've been putting extra beads in all the rosaries. And she said, and I know why. And I remember thinking, I hope she tells me, because I have the foggiest notion of why I do these things. She said, people all over the world, she said, you know, we send those rosaries to the missions all over the world. And she said, people all over the world are praying extra prayers, and God's going to give you all the credit. Don't you just hate people like that? People in Alcoholics Anonymous are like that, you know? I mean, what I've discovered about people in Alcoholics Anonymous, from the very beginning, people subscribed the best motives to my behavior, even when they weren't my motives. And that's what she did. She would find what was best in what I did and believe that to be true. And her thought was, one day it will be. And you know, when I was a kid growing up, I was telling a friend of mine tonight, I had a horrible speech impediment. No one could understand me except the people who loved me. And then something happened to basically a miracle, and I was able to learn to talk. But she told me that day that I copped to what I'd been doing, that when she first met me, she said, I knew that you were very special. And she said, so I put a medal on my beads, and whenever I get to it, I say a special prayer for you, because one day you're going to go all around the world telling God's children how much he loves them. And it terrified me that I could be expected to do something. Just terrified me. I was a guy who wanted, I desired greatly to be noticed, and then I was afraid to be noticed. One of the things I discovered when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and began to do my inventory work was that I not only had a lot of fears, my problem was my fears were always in conflict with one another. I was a guy who was afraid to be alone, and I was afraid to be close to people. That causes a problem. What I did was jump in and out of relationships. I gave double messages. I would invite someone to be close to me because I was desperately afraid of being alone. And then the minute that there was any intimacy at all, I'd become frightened of that, and I'd begin pushing them away. I'll tell you, more than one woman in my life said, what is it you want anyway? And I remember thinking, that's a very good question, because I have the foggiest notion. Depends on what time of the day it is. I don't know. You know, I was a guy who was afraid of failure, definitely afraid of failure. But I was afraid of success, too. And if I began to fail, it terrified me. Because I knew where I'd go. We'd go to the poorhouse. My dad used to say it all the time. If I lose my job, we're going to go to the poorhouse. And I didn't know where it was, but I didn't want to go. I can tell you that. Because it wasn't a nice place, because Dad was afraid to go there. And I wanted nothing to do with it. So I'd work like crazy. I went to work when I was 12 years old and essentially worked from then until now. And yet, I was afraid of a success, too. Because if you're successful, people begin to expect things from you. I was always a guy who somehow wanted to be in the middle. You know, I somehow wanted to hide in the middle of life. Remember when I graduated from high school, which surprised a lot of people, I had no idea what I wanted to do, and I knew that if I went away, I'd be okay, because if I went away, people wouldn't know I didn't know what it was I wanted to do. They'd think I was away doing it. So I decided to go away, and the way you go away, you know, back then, It's 1961. She joined the service. All men went into the service. It wasn't a matter of if. It was where and when. Those were the questions, you know. And so I took one of my very first inventories. I stood in front of the mirror, and I took my shirt off, and I flexed my muscles, and I turned sideways, stuck my chest out, you know. I was 5 feet, 1 inch tall. I weighed 113 pounds. And whatever else I was a born killer. So I went over to Wheeling, West Virginia, and found a recruiter and joined the Marine Corps. And my parents had to sign for me. I wasn't yet 18, and I forgot to tell them what I had decided. So the recruiter shows up at my house and with the papers for my parents to sign up. My poor mother, my poor saintly mother, just lost it, you know. And I remember she cried all night. She kept saying, "Scott, they'll kill him." And my dad kept saying, "Don't worry, Pat, they won't take him." So with that vote of confidence, the next morning, I got on a Trailways or a Greyhound bus in Wheeling, West Virginia, and I went to Pittsburgh. Now, Georgian people can tell you, that's about a 60-mile trip. And it's the second longest trip I'd ever been on. Once I went to Cleveland, you know, I mean, I knew all about the world. And I'm this 17-year-old kid who's absolutely terrified, and I joined the Marine Corps, and three other guys joined from the Pittsburgh area, and that night we went over to a bar, and that's when it happened for me. That's when that thing happened that made life make sense to me. I went in there a frightened, skinny little kid who didn't know anything about anything. And somewhere between the second and third beer, my life changed. It was just that dramatic. It was that dramatic. I remember I went into the place. I never forget. It was just filled with real men, you know, and they all real men have real women with them, you know. Guys like me used to get what was left. And they just knew everything. I mean, I knew they knew everything, and I didn't know anything. Three drinks later, I looked around the same bar, and the place was filled with a bunch of pathetic, snivelling little men. You know. And all of them had women with them or looking at me with their hungry eyes. You know how they do it. My life, I had arrived. I mean, I knew it. I remember saying, "Of course it's so simple." And it's like for the first time in my life, I understood the big picture. The very first time in my life, I understood the big picture. Life finally made sense to me. And I spent the next 3 or 4 hours going from table to table, explaining life to people. You know? And it came time to leave, and we had to catch a train that night. And it seemed to me, now this may not be entirely accurate, but this is my perception. When I was leaving that place, people were saying, "Please don't go, we've just discovered you." You know? And I said, "No, I have to go and make the world safe for democracy." I went, and somewhere between that bar and the train, I went into my very first blackout. And I woke up the next morning lying on the floor of the Pullman coach that the Marine Corps had provided for me. And someone had wet the floor I was lying on, and whoever it was, he had wet me too. I have no idea who did that. I was the only one in there. And I changed my clothes, and I got off the train, and the guys are waiting on the platform, and they said, "Look, our train's not going. Next train doesn't leave for about 4 hours. We're going to go over and have a few beers." And I said, "That's just what I was thinking." And I followed them over there. And that night, I fell off a train up here in Yamsey, South Carolina. I never forget it. I just fell off the train. And there was a very rude man there they had sent to greet us. And he was hurling obscenities at myself and the other young men who'd gone down there to die for their country. And I remember I got up and I brushed myself off, and this guy was just screaming and everything. And I tried to explain to him that he might get a little further with us if he treat us with a little respect. And he's a very limited man. He didn't seem to understand exactly what it was I was trying to say. You know, they say you learn something from every experience. And I'll tell you what I learned from that experience is you can do a lot of push-ups drunk. That's what I learned from that experience. And I was launched into the Marine Corps. And I enjoyed what Mark said about boot camp. I, too, loved boot camp. I loved everything about it. And I often wondered why. I mean, besides the second step. I often wonder why I loved the Marine Corps so much, and I especially loved Paris Island. And I think I finally figured it out. I mean, I was sober 25 years, and I finally think I figured it out. It's the first time in my life that I knew exactly what was expected of me. I spent my whole life guessing at life. But, you know, in the Marine Corps, especially in boot camp, they have a real clear idea of what's expected of you, you know, and they're not a bit hesitant about sharing it with you, you know. So I knew exactly what was, and I didn't have to guess at life when I was in the Marine Corps. Now, it sounds silly, but I guessed at life my whole life, and I didn't have to guess anymore. All I had to do was do, and I've discovered it. I can do. I'm just not good at guessing. And so I won, I graduated from Paris Island with Dress Blues Award, now Standing Man's Award. I got all this stuff. They think if you're small, you can't do anything. I love it. You know, the world's filled with large mutants. And, you know, and they all think that if you're small, you don't know anything and you can't do anything. You're incompetent somehow. You know, I could do more push-ups one-handed. Most of these bozos could do it too, you know. So it was easy for me. The physical part was really very easy for me. You know, and I packed on about 30 pounds and I grew a few inches. And the Marine Corps was very good for me. And I was going to stay as long as they'd let me stay. I loved it. I loved everything about it. And I was going to stay forever. The problem was I had this thing called alcoholism. And what alcoholism means to me is that I'll fall madly in love with a way of life. I mean, you know, if you look around this place this weekend, you cannot accuse alcoholics of not being enthusiastic. We are certainly enthusiastic. And I've always been like that. I was enthusiastic drunk. And I'd fall in love with a way of life. And then gradually or not so gradually, I'd begin violating every principle associated with that way of life. And that's what I did in the Marine Corps. Every promotion I ever got was a meritorious promotion. I was offered a commission. Of course, in 1965, that wasn't a particularly big deal because they were getting people opening up the 4th Marine Division for Vietnam. But I was offered all this stuff. And I was going to take it all. The problem was, I was an alcoholic. And I ended up violating every principle associated with being a Marine. And I loved the Marine Corps. Up to and including, I led a patrol in a blackout in the combat zone. We took fire. I don't remember going out. I don't remember coming back. And I got up the next morning, and I was fully clothed. I had my .45 on. There was a round in the chamber. There was a hammer back, and 3 rounds were missing. And that isn't the way I normally slept. And I knew something very bad had happened the night before. And we were in Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic, in 65. And they were waking me up and wanting me to go to report what happened on patrol the night before. And I wasn't supposed to go on patrol, so I got drunk. And the guy who was supposed to go was sick, and they came and got me. And I got up and got dressed. Took, by the grace of God, no one was hurt. I don't think on either side. But I could never tell them what happened. I could never tell them what happened because I don't remember. And that frightened me, and I came back from there and turned down the commission and got out. And then, of course, I blamed them for what had happened to me. And that's the story of my alcoholism. That's what happened in my marriage. I married a woman. We had 2 beautiful children. I violated every principle associated with being a husband. And then I left that and blamed her for what had happened to me. And that's the story. That's my alcoholism. It isn't any more dramatic than that. There are some things that happened during that time which I think are important, that point out to me what it means to be powerless, you know, that what this first step is all about, this whole business about being powerless. I ended up working. I went to school and worked at Georgetown University, and I was directing a genetics laboratory there, and I was just getting sicker and sicker by the minute. And my wife had our second child, I was directing a genetics laboratory there, and of course I was drunk when the baby came, and she finally woke me up, and she was almost 3 months premature. She weighed about 2 pounds, or a little less than 2 pounds, and no one expected her to live. And they put her in this neonatal nursery at the university hospital, and we had offices across from the nursery, and they put her on this experimental machine, very common now, but it was the first one on the East Coast, and they had gotten it 3 days before this little thing was born. And I remember sitting in my office with the light out, cowering in the dark, watching this little girl struggle for every breath that she could take, and watching my wife walk up and down the hall with a 1,000-yard stare, and basically in a state of shock, because we knew that the little girl wasn't going to live. And they said if she lived, she'd be retarded. And I remember the night at 72 hours, it's a particularly critical time, and my wife went in and baptized her because we didn't think she'd live through the night. And I was sitting in the dark watching this. And I knew what to do. I mean, my father knew how to be a father. He knew how to be a husband. And I knew what my father would have done. He'd have gone in there, that stoic look on his face, and put his arm around his wife and said, "We'll do this together." So I knew what to do. There was just nothing left inside of me to do it with. And I never want to forget that night, because that night I went down into this little chapel, and I loved church as a kid. I used to stop by in front of the tabernacle, and when I'd go play ball or something, I'd run by the church, and I'd run in. The churches were open then, you know. Ron, you can even leave your cars open then. And the churches were open then, and I'd run into church, and I'd say, "Hi, Jesus." So I just came by to say, "Hi, I'm going to go play ball. You want to come, you can." And that's the kind of relationship I had with God. I wasn't fearful or anything of God. And I had lost all of that. That's the price you pay for the next drink, I think. And I went into that chapel, and I never forget it as long as I live. I got on my knees, and I wept. It was the middle of the night, and I just wept. And I begged God to let my little girl live. And I said, "If you let her live, I'll do anything. If you let her live, I'll stop drinking." And I was drunk in 12 hours. I drank when I thought drinking would kill my little girl. She didn't die. She retarded. She lived, and it's a miracle, absolutely a miracle. And she 2 years ago, Christmas, had my first grandchild, a little girl, gorgeous little girl. She lives over in Daphne, Alabama, and she graduated with honors from Auburn. I always tell her, I think you can be retarded and graduate from honors with all. She's just a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful girl, and married a really neat guy. And next month she's having her second daughter, and my other daughter Kelly's having my first grandson. But you know, I never want to forget when I thought that drinking would kill my little girl. Couldn't keep me from drinking. There's a French philosopher, Blaise Pascal. He's a mathematician. Said, you know, when God created man, and unfortunately man in his own image, and unfortunately man returned a favor. And I had created a God in my sickness. I had created a God who would kill a little kid because her dad was sick. And that's not the way God functions. Just not the way he functions. I never want to forget. I remember being at Kimberly's anniversary party. And I was just overwhelmed. And she said to me, "What's the matter, Daddy?" And I said, "I have a story to tell you sometime." And so we went outside, and I was able to tell her that story. That I thought drinking would kill her, and I had to drink. And you know, it was something like 2 years later, after my wife asked me to leave, and I ended up living in a Skid Row section of Washington, D.C., and then I got to the point where I couldn't leave the place, and I was drinking around the clock, and I was somewhere in the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th day of a binge, and I went in to commit suicide. And you know, anybody who's alcoholic knows that the suicide's not a big deal to an alcoholic. Suicide's just the next thing. It's almost like, you know, whatever it cost is what I paid. You know, one day I went into the NCO club and I had an appointment to go to Officers Canada School at Quantico, Virginia, and I had all the things I'd worked 4 years for. And I ordered a double scotch on the rocks, and I said, "How much is that?" He said, "$0.60 in your commission." And I thought, that's about right, and I paid it. And then one day I went for a bottle of gin or something, and I said, "How much is that?" And he said, "Well, it'll be $6.75 in your wife and your two children." And I thought, well, that's about right, you know, to get back to Pittsburgh, to that night in Pittsburgh when life worked for me, and I paid it. And then the payment for the next drink was just my life. And I went into this bathroom, and I had a lot of pills and stuff, and, you know, I worked in hospitals, and they noticed I had a nervous condition. I'd like bang my eyes on the microscope and stuff, and so they were always giving me stuff. And back then, you could go into what they called a brewer, and you could take whatever you wanted, you know. And I never took pills. I was always afraid of them. I know some of you think that's the saddest story you ever heard, but I just never took them. So I had a whole medicine cabinet full, and I went in and decided to take my life. And something happened. A woman spoke to me. I won't go into it now, but she told me not to do it. And it took me 6 years to understand that. And again, I won't go into it now, but I remembered that this woman who I persecuted, that's the only way I can describe the way I treated my wife. I abused her in many, many ways. And when I left, she gave me two phone numbers. And she said, "I can't help you. Maybe these people can." And I remembered them. And I ran out and I pulled a drawer out and everything fell on the floor. And I found one number and I called it. And it was a little treatment center. And And I called him. And I just said, I didn't know these people. I didn't know what they did, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. I just said to him, if you can't help me, I think I'm going to die. And a woman heard it in my voice. She was a recovering person, and she knew what was going on with me. And she asked me for my phone number. She said, I'll have to call you right back. And of course, she wanted to get my phone number so she could call the police if she had to. And she called me back, and we talked, and she said, you know, we can take you in a few days. Do you need help stopping? And I didn't know what she's talking about. I never stopped. And in the next 3 days, I went through stuff that we used to see alcoholics go through all the time, convulsions, and I heard things. And I had to go borrow some money on this alcoholic car I had, and I went to the bank, and I was hearing Beethoven's Fifth Symphony I put a nickel in a parking meter, and Beethoven's Fifth Symphony would come blaring out of it, you know. And I was standing there for a little while, and came out of the radiator of my car, and I was sitting in the bank talking to the bank president, and I'm going, like, you know, back and forth listening to this marvelous music, and he's looking at me oddly, and I realized that they didn't have Muzak. I was the only one who was hearing this stuff, and I'd see those things out of the corner of my eye, and I was very, very sick, and somehow 3 days later I knew it was time to go, and it took me 6 hours to drive 30 miles. I was so fearful. I guess they'd call it a panic attack. They used to call it the running fits. And I'd drive about a mile, and I'd be sick and terrified, and I'd shake, and I'd get out of the car, and I'd cry, and I'd run up and down the side of the road and be sick, and I wet my pants. And I'm changing my pants, and my Phi Theta Kappa key fell out on the ground. And I was one of these kids who had all this potential, you know. Damn it, I was going to save it for when I really needed it, and it was gone. And then I'd wondered what had happened in my life. I was 29 years old, my life was over. And it took me 6 hours, and I got to this place, and they put me on a bus, and they told me they were taking me to a place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I asked, what's this? And the guy said, that's some place. He said, we got a church basement. It's a bunch of old people, you know, preach to us. I'm thinking, I'll take anything. And so we went there, and we got off the bus, and I walked up, and there was an old man standing at the door, an obnoxious old man, you know, kind of looking in the eye, you know, the kind, you know. I was a shoe guy. I like to look at shoes, but this guy looking me in the eye. And he said to me, you know, he said, if you keep coming here, son, you never have to drink again. And I wanted to say to him, you don't know me. I'm a guy who drinks when he thinks drinking will kill his little girl. But he did know me. And from that day till this one, I've not had to take a drink of alcohol. He knew me better than I knew myself. You've always known me better than I've known myself. And he took me inside and he introduced me to an old woman who sat with me and got me a half a cup of coffee and just patted me. Now the skin's moving around on my body and this old broad's patting me, you know. Now, at any moment I thought I'd go flying out of my chair or something. And halfway through the meeting, they have a break and people go for coffee and they take up the collection, have the secretary's report. She looked over at me and smiled, and she said, you know, Sonny, you keep coming here, you never have to be alone again. And I began to cry. I didn't know that what I was alone. But that's what I've been my whole life. And the reason I know I'm alone was because I could never be on the outside what I suspected I was on the inside. I always had to make up something. I had to be somebody else. I always had to tell you something or create something for you so you would take me. Because I knew you'd never take me the way I was. And I've come to discover in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's all I have. And that's all you've ever wanted, is what I am. And you understand me. You understand my arrogance at 6 years and my craziness at 12 years and my leading deaconship at 20 years. And you just understand. You just take me exactly the way I am. And that's the way I am because, you know, if I keep coming back, I'll be different. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're kind of new, I got to warn you, Alcoholics Anonymous really is about building character. It really is about building character. If I'm the same man this time next year I am this time this year, I've failed in Alcoholics Anonymous. If I'm not a better husband, a better father, a better sponsor, a better brother, a better son, a better friend, a better child of God, this time next year I am this time this year, I've failed in my program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Of course I need to be sober. Nothing can happen if I'm not sober. But that's not what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. It's about growing. That's why Diz loves the history so much and why he loves the book so much. We don't naturally get or automatically get better. We get better because we work at this thing. And I threw myself into it from the very beginning. I like to joke about old-timers. I got to stop that pretty soon because I'm one of these days I'm going to be one. But I like to joke about old-timers. And I used to hang around old-timers. I just loved being around them. They were just being around them was peaceful. Now, they ragged me to death. They just torment me to, you know. And I used to go to when I first got sober, I thought that being sober was about solving problems, you know. I thought, well, I got to look and see what my problems are, and then I have to solve my problem. And so I'd hang with a bunch of losers. You know, we were sort of like the problem of the month group, you know. And we'd come up with this problem, and they'd say, go ask the old-timer. And I'd say, I'm not going to ask them. They don't like me. And they'd say, yeah, they like you. Go ask them. And so I'd go ask the old-timer. And old-timers never give you answers. You ever notice that? They never answer a question. You know, never. They speak in parables. And they have you do your stuff. They have you doing stuff. Has nothing to do with the problem. It's just a wonderful, wonderful way to live it. And so I go to the old-timer and I tell him a problem I had. And he always laugh at your problems. You know, that's what old-timers do. They laugh at your problems. That's what they're good at, is laughing at you. And so I go tell them a problem. First thing you do is laugh. And I'll tell you, if you really want to make their day, tell them a problem about sex. They love, don't they? They love problems about sex. And the answer is always the same, no sex. All right? They're not having sex anymore, and they don't want us to have it either. That's right. So I was sober a few months, and I was impotent. Now, I thought that's a problem. I mean, you know, you're 29 years old, and you're impotent, so. And it wasn't one I was willing to talk to my sponsor about, because I didn't think he'd want to sponsor a guy who was impotent. So I went to the old-timer, and I told him what my problem was. He just burst into laughter. Oh! And he said, a lot of us had that problem when we first came here. He said, it'll get better. I said, when? I thought it was important. He said, I don't know, a couple of years. I said, a couple of years? I can't wait a couple of years. He said, what do you got, a full social calendar? Going to take her to your little place down on Skid Row and impress her? So the next month, I go back with another problem, you know. And I never learn. Just never learn. And I'm sober about 3 months, and I go back with this problem. And you know what he tells me? I just think about this. He said, you have a lot of problems, don't you? I said, I have a lot of problems. He said, you probably have hundreds. I said, thousands. He said, you have thousands of problems. And he said, let me make a suggestion. I said, anything. I'm honest, willing, and open-minded. And he said, let me suggest that you borrow some lipstick from one of the girls in the program. He said, now, I don't want you doing anything else with the girls in the program. He said, oh, that's right, you can't. He said, I want you to borrow some lipstick, and I want you to go home right on the mirror. Keith, you were wrong. And I said, well, I can't do that. You see, my problem is I have a poor self-image, and I need to be esteemed. I need to be affirmed, and I need to develop some self-esteem. Don't ever talk that way to old-timers. They hadn't read any of those books. So he said, get some. And so I went out and bought a tube of lipstick. I didn't want to owe anything to anybody, you know, especially a woman, right, guys? And so I bought this tube, and I went home, and I wrote on the mirror, Keith, you were wrong. And I just threw it in the trash. I said, these people are nuts. They're crazy. What's this got to do with my problem? And I remember I went to bed. It was a normal night. I don't know if you remember a normal night at 90 days or something, but, you know, like I closed my eyes and my brain woke up for the first time that day and it took off, you know. Oh, you're never going to make it. They're going to find out you're not an alcoholic. You're really a nut, and they're going to kick you out of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're going to be alone the rest of your life. What difference does it make? You're impotent. You know, just on. Like my mind is running a million miles an hour, you know, and then I finally fall asleep, and then leg cramps would set in. I don't know if anybody remembers a leg cramp, but a leg cramps, and I'd be jumping up and down beside the bed trying to get rid of the leg cramps, and then 15 minutes before I had to get ready for work, I'd go sound asleep. And it would take 3 alarms to wake me up, and, you know, and I'd wake up, and my brain was still awake, and it was saying things like, you're going to go to work today, and they're going to find out you don't know how to do your job, and they're going to fire you. What difference does it make? You're hopelessly in debt. I mean, just a normal day, and I went out, and I started a coffee. I just wanted to cry, you know. And I went in the bathroom, and I looked at the mirror, and it said, Keith, you're wrong. I said, well, thank God, because if I'm right, I'm in a hell of a lot of trouble. And I came to understand that the great gift of Alcoholics Anonymous is being wrong, just being wrong about stuff. I was such an angry, angry young man, you know, such an angry young man. And I was angry because I was wrong. I was wrong about how life works. I was wrong about how God works. I was wrong about everything. That's why I was angry. I was angry because I was frightened. I was filled with fear. I'll tell you how fearful I was. I was afraid of heights. You know, I'm just afraid of heights. And I never could tell my wife, the woman I was married to, that I was afraid of heights. Now, if you can't tell the person who loves you more than anybody in the world what's wrong with you, who can you tell? That's how fearful I was. That's how isolated and alone I was. And when I got sober, that rage was there. It was just always under the surface. We were talking about it tonight. One of the ways for me early on, suicide really looked like the best option for me because I couldn't live the way I was living and I didn't know there were any other options. But in the treatment center, I got this mistaken notion that it was about solving problems, that if I could solve enough problems, maybe I could live enough problem-free to survive in life. And I thought it was about feelings. And so I go to a meeting, and I would try to think of what problem I'm going to discuss. Fortunately, they'd never ask me, you know. And at the end of the meeting, they'd say, does anybody here have a problem that might make them drink before they go? I'd put my hand up, and I'd say, I can't sleep. And they'd take turns. You know how they love to pick on a new guy. They'd say, nobody ever died from not sleeping. Yeah. But one day, I mean, you don't want to talk that way to a guy who isn't sleeping. It's crazy. I'll just tell you this, okay? And so I jumped up one day and screamed, no, but people died from saying nobody ever died from not sleeping. It was the last time they said that to me. And then I remember, I needed to fit into Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew if I couldn't make an Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a dead man, and I knew that. And so I tried to do and say the right things just so I could belong here, so you'd let me stay here. And I remember, I was in a meeting one time, I was sober about 5 or 6 weeks, and there was a topic. And it was from the book, and it got to me, and I shared my feelings, you know, and a great hush came over the crowd, and then they went on with the meeting, and the next week I went back, and a guy said to me, he said, you stay sober all week? I said, yes, sir. And he said, well, I'm really glad. He said, you know, we had a business meeting last week after you left. He said, the vote was 12 to nothing. Nobody cares how you feel. He said, we care about what you do. He said, this isn't a program where you check your feelings. He said, this is a program where you look at your actions. He said, sobriety is a set of actions. He said, recovery is a set of actions that you take even though they don't make sense. You don't take them because you feel like it or you feel good or you feel bad. You take them because that's what sober people do. And he said, one day if you do a certain set of actions that right now don't make sense to you, one day you'll walk with dignity and you'll consider yourself a moral man. He said, that's what we do here. He said, how you feel? He said, if you don't like the way you feel, wait 5 minutes. You'll feel differently. And he's exactly right. He's exactly right. My emotions were always on a roller coaster. The only time they weren't on a roller coaster when I was drinking, somewhere between the second and third drink. And then towards the end, even that didn't work. And I could be a raving lunatic or a sobbing idiot. So it isn't about feelings. Now, of course, we can't deny our feelings. I know all of that. But it's about action. And I waste a lot of time spinning their wheels, wait until they feel like doing something. And trust me, don't do it. Just do what you're supposed to do. Get a good sponsor, a sponsor who lays out a good plan of action. Take the plan of action. You know, good bosses are like that, huh? Ever say to your boss, well, I'll do that as soon as I feel like it? Probably won't work, unless you work for yourself. So please, we don't give advice in Alcoholics Anonymous, but be careful with that stuff. The other thing is problem deal. I actually go to a meeting from time to time where the person who chairs the meeting says, does anybody here have a problem? And I always say, alcoholism, I got alcoholism. And I go, oh, he's back. And then this one meeting says, we usually read from the book unless someone has a problem. And we'll discuss that. And I say, maybe the solution's in the book. It's just a stab in the dark. But maybe the solution's in the book, you know. It's amazing to me, you know, so somebody will come up with a problem, you know, like mother has a square nipple, you know, I mean, you know, something, you know, and 50 untrained psychiatrists will give their opinion of that, you know, and what's that got to do with anything, you know, I mean, this is time we could spend learning about things. I remember where I got sober, and I'm very glad for this, where I got sober, they got you into action right away. And I was sober, you know, I was sober four or five weeks. They had me going to institutions with them. I was the guy who took the extra pack of cigarettes. What do? You bring an extra pack of cigarettes. You know, you'll be a hit with an extra pack of cigarettes. You know, pass out cigarettes. You know, like I'm going to the Howard Pavilion for the criminally insane, you know, and I'm giving out cigarettes to the guy who just chopped somebody up. You know, I mean, just great stuff. And they had you leading meetings really early. And I remember I went to Wheeling, West Virginia. I was sober about 3.5 months. I went to Wheeling, West Virginia. They found out I hadn't spoken or given a lead yet. They canceled the guy who was supposed to speak and made me give a lead. They said, "You mean you're sober 90 days and you haven't given a lead yet? How are you making it?" I think, "Well, I think I'm feeling pretty good. You know, so you got to talk." So I had to talk that night. And they had me leading meetings at 3 and 4 and 5 months. You know. And I remember I wanted to impress. I needed you people so badly. I'd always loved the kind of people you were, and I always secretly wanted to be just like you. And I remember wanting to impress you. So what I thought I'd do is I studied like crazy. I'm going to lead this meeting. And I studied like crazy. And I was cramming. I had little notes. I'm sitting out in the car reading my little 3 of 5 cards, you know. And, you know, I had a hose in my brain. I couldn't remember anything, but I'm trying like crazy to remember this. And here was the scheme, see. I was going to go into this meeting, and I was going to be cool, and I was going to say something like, well, I haven't had time to prepare a topic, and then I was going to say something just brilliant, you know, and you'd say, "My God, if he did that without preparing, what could he do if he prepared? We got a genius on our hands," you know. It didn't work out exactly that way. I got as far as the part where I said, "I didn't have time to prepare a topic," and this old timer said, "Then shut up. If you don't care enough about us to prepare a topic, we don't need to listen to your dribbling." He said, "Is there someone around here who's prepared a topic recently?" And this brown nose down the table puts up his hand and said, "I led a meeting a few days ago on resentments." He said, "Good, you lead the meeting. There's at least one guy here who needs it, you know." So I learned never to admit if I hadn't prepared a topic. But it's unbelievable to me that people lead a meeting and not prepare a topic. It just amazes me. You know, I mean, what this is about is for me to learn how to live differently. I need to learn how to live life differently. It isn't about solving problems. I used to think it was. And they sent me, I was talking to a friend, Jeff Matt, who's familiar with the Metropolis Club in Washington, D.C., And I was sent down, they used to send you around to talk to different people. "Well, I don't know about that. Go talk to so-and-so." And I went down to talk to an old-timer at the Metropolis Club. And I can't remember what the problem was. It was a big problem in July of 73, whatever it was. A lot of people had it. And my thought was, if I don't find the answer to this problem, I have to drink. I don't know where I got that. Probably thought it up myself. So I'm looking for this guy. And I went down there, and he wasn't there. And I'm in the middle of a crisis, and he's not there. And a woman said, "He'll be back. He's out on a 12-step call." And so he comes in, and he's dragging a drunk with him. I ran over and said, "I got to talk to you." I said, "I got to talk to you right now. It's really important." And he said, "Well, we're going to start our meeting now." I said, "I may not be alive at the end of the meeting." He said, "You sit next to me. People sit next to me never die." So I sat next to him. And when the meeting was over, I told him this problem. And I never forget it. I mean, he looked at me and he scratched his head and he was a beautiful man. He's a black man and had real white eyebrows. Been sober a long time. And he said to me, "You know, boy," he said, "I don't know what to tell you." I said, "You were my last hope." And he said, "Well, let me make a suggestion." I said, "Anything." He said, "Don't drink, even if your ass falls off." I remember driving home thinking, that's the most profound thing I ever heard in my life. And I suddenly understood how this thing worked. It's not about solving problems, you know. I mean, why should I solve problems? It's a lot like my wife and I, okay? We'll be married 11 years in May. And we've known one another 15 years. We've had two arguments, two disagreements. They weren't even arguments. I mean, you know. I mean, they would have qualified as getting along well in my first marriage. We're married about a month, and we're disagreeing, and it's our second disagreement. And I began to raise my voice, and I stopped. And I said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "I love you more than anybody in the world, and I'm beginning to raise my voice at you." And she said, she said, "I'm going to raise my voice at you too." And I said, "You know, the 10th step tells me that it's a spiritual axiom. Whenever there's a problem between me and someone else, there's problems with me." I said, "I'm going to go call my sponsor and find out what's wrong with me." And she said, "I'm going to call my sponsor." She's now in that. She said, "I'm going to call my sponsor and find out what's wrong with me." And from that day to this, we haven't had to have a disagreement. You know, we don't do things like get together and discuss it. You know what getting together and talking it out means? It means I want another opportunity to change your mind. That's all it means. That's all it means. You know? I'll present it to you in another way. Even an idiot like you ought to get it this time. I mean, you know, that's what it means. Yeah. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and of course the reason I love Alcoholics Anonymous is because I owe my life, I owe everything to it. Somebody said to me one time, "You ever get tired of going and talking and all this stuff?" And I guess the answer is sometimes I get tired. I'm not as young as I used to be. But I'll tell you why. I mean, I'm so deeply in debt to Alcoholics Anonymous that I can't even pay the principal and the interest anymore. And the longer I'm with you, the more in debt I am. And you've taught me and given me everything that I have. The kind of father I am, the kind of husband I am, is directly related to everything you ever taught me. And you even took all the wonderful spiritual training that I received as a child and you made it make sense to me. I learned and heard a lot of good stuff as a kid. I grew up with people who were love machines. They knew all about loving. But I just didn't know what to do with it. And you taught me. And of course you taught me through the steps. And I wanted, if I could, just spend just a couple minutes talking about the steps, particularly the 9th step. You know, I had to start my amends process, and I had a pretty good list of people. And it, one of the people at the top of the list was good old dumb Denny. And because I had gone to great lengths to try to detract from Denny. I mean, it's hard to live in a house with a guy like Denny and who did everything once. And so I went to visit Denny, and I told him why I was there, and we talked. And his wife left and let us talk, and we talked well into the morning. And we talked about when we were kids and we played ball together and we were best friends. And I said to him, I said, "You know, Dan," I said, "every chance I got to say something negative about you," I said, "I took it." And I said, "There weren't many chances, but I didn't pass any up." And I said, "The last 6 months, every chance I've had to say something positive, I've taken it." And I said, I stand willing to do anything else I can do to amend that relationship because I want us to be best friends again." And he said, "If you owe me an amends, then I owe you an amends too." He said, "My whole life I've envied you." He said, "I've always been afraid." He said, "I've been afraid to change. I've been afraid to try something different." And he said, "I've always watched you." And he said, "You never seem to give a damn about anything." He said, "If things weren't going well for you in one country, you go to another country." And he said, "You went clear to Skid Row and you lost everything you ever had and you came back." And he said, "I'd love to be the man you are." And I discovered that we aren't good and bad, we're just different. And we celebrate that difference. I'll be out in California playing at his golf course. I let him pay. He's got all the money. You know. He slept on the right side of the bed. Let him pay. But we're just best friends. You imagine, I'm the executor of his estate. You imagine such a thing? That he wouldn't think of anybody else but me. Because he says, "You're the most ethical man I've ever met, an alcoholic." I think about my dad, a man who never told me he loved me. And I would try to, I've got a theory about men and their fathers in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really believe this to be true. I don't know about out of Alcoholics Anonymous, but in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've never seen a man who doesn't get it right with dad ever do well. I think every man who does well gets it right with dad. Whatever that is, whether he's alive or dead or whatever kind of... It's not about what kind of a father he was. I mean, my father happened to be a great father. He just couldn't say those words, "I love you." And
And I'd try to make amends to him, and I'd go home and I'd be angry. I'd just be around him a little while and I'd get angry, this anger. I'd drive 300 miles. I'd have a cup of coffee with him. I'd get so angry, get up and walk out. And one day he said to my mother, "You know, I like to see Keith, but I worry about that boy. He said, he drives a long way for a cup of coffee. You know, no earthly idea what's going on, you know." And of course he wasn't. He was making a living trying to raise 11 children. And then they raised kids that didn't have any place else to go. They just come to our house. And one day, my mom and dad had never seen the ocean, and I had a beach house down in North Carolina, and they came down, and my brother Larry took them down to the ocean. Larry's in AA now, and he was telling me that Dad stood and watched the ocean. He'd never seen it before, and the waves were crashing in, and he said, "Son, does it just keep going that?" He said, "Well, as long as I've watched it, it has, you know." And they'd never been on a vacation. Of course, they'd never been on a vacation. And so I was moving to Alabama to do some work, and I asked him, I said, "You know, I've got this beach house here," and I said, "I hate to leave it." I said, "I wonder if you're keeping an eye on it for me." And he said, "Well, don't you worry about the house. We'll watch it." And they kept an eye on it for 6 years. I couldn't get them out of it. But I was an officer with this hospital corporation, and I was running around and being a big deal and things. And every chance I got, I'd get by there, and I'd just spend time with Dad. And we're sitting one day. I'll never forget. We're both sitting in rocking chairs, rocking. And Dad said to me, he said, remember the first day you went to work? And I said, "Yeah." I said, "I had a job at the bowling alley in Bridgeport." He said, "Yeah." He said, "You remember before you went to work, I took you to lunch?" I said, "I don't remember that." He said, "Yeah." He said, "We went to Louis' hot dog stand." And he said, "You remember what you ate?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to go out on a limb here, Dad. Did I have a hot dog?" He said, "Of course you did, you know." He said, "Do you remember what you drank?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "I probably drank an orange pop. I always drank orange." And he said, "Not that day." He said, "That day you had a root beer." He said, "I drank root beer, and I think you thought men who work drank root beer." He said, "I explained to you what it was like to do a good day's work for a good day's wage, and that you owed your boss respect, and your boss owed you respect." And what he did was he told me how to grow up. And he said, "I took you down to the bus stop. I had to go to the next town." And he said, "I said to you, 'Son, do you want me to come with you the first day?' And you said, 'No, thanks, Dad. I'll do it myself.'" And he said, "My little boy got on the bus." And he said, "I watched the bus till it was out of sight. You never looked back." And he said, "From then on," he said, "I never felt as though I had any say in your life." He said, "You paid your own way." He said, "You bought your own clothes." He said, "You put yourself through college." And I was the oldest son. I thought I was supposed to do that. And I realized that what I owed him an amends for was that I never allowed him to do what he's best at, and that's being a father. And a few months later, I needed to borrow a couple $1,000 from him. And he gave me the money. And then I paid him back a few months later. And every time I talk to him now, he tells me he loves me. That's what the eighth step says, isn't it? It really says that people treat us the way we make them treat us. My brother Terry had alcoholism, the same disease I had. And when I was sober about 3 years, Terry got sober for 90 days a couple times. It just never happened for him. I guess God didn't need him sober to have him do what he needed to do. And I had Terry on my amends list, and I could never find him. And finally, I chased him down. And my parents were celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary, and I knew Terry would have to come to that. And my lovely wife, Julie, had never even met Terry. And she met him for the first time, and we were having a big celebration. And like I say, you know, they had 20 grandchildren, 20-some great-grandchildren. And all these kids they helped raise came and brought their children. And it was a magnificent time. And everybody was there but Terry. And Terry came kind of late, and he was very drunk. And my brother Henry came and said, "Terry's here, and he's drunk." I said, "Of course he's drunk. He's an alcoholic." And I said, He said, "He shouldn't be here like that." I said, "Of course he shouldn't be here like that, but that's the only way he can be." And I said, "I know what he's been doing, because I'd have done the same thing. He's been right down the street trying to get enough beer in him so he could come here." I said, "He must love them an awful lot to come here like that." It was like they were all free to love Terry just the way he was. And so we loved Terry the way he was. And a few months later, he was diagnosed with cancer, and he was in the hospital. And I wish you'd known Terry. He was a great guy. He had the best sense of humor in the world. He's a mathematical wizard. He could do anything. He was a great boxer. Golly, he was a good boxer. But he'd gotten beaten pretty badly because he was in bars, and he thought he was still a great boxer. And he'd been beaten badly, almost to death a couple times. And, He didn't have many teeth left, and most of the bones in his face had been broken, and all that stuff. And I went to see him in the hospital, and just the two of us talked, and we talked for a couple hours, and he had a lot of questions. He knew that he had lung cancer, and he knew he didn't have lung, and he began to ask me things that you would ask a big brother, maybe. Things like, is there a God, and does he really care about a guy like me? I was able to tell him, yes, I know there is, and yes, I know he does. And we talked about things, and we talked about things that were important to us as kids, rosaries and scapulars, and things that we learned about in our church, and he said, you wouldn't happen to have any of those, would you? I said, I just happen to have a couple in my pocket. And we talked about how to use them, and we talked about some other things, and I was getting ready to leave, and he smiled at me, and he said, you know, he said, I didn't leave town. And I said, I know. I said, I'm so glad. And then I asked him for a favor. I said, could I hug you? And he got out of bed, and he was so frail. And here's a guy who could just clean your clock in a heartbeat. And he weighed less than 100 pounds now, and he's so frail and everything. And I hugged him, and, you know, he's still an alcoholic, so he couldn't hug for long. And you know, after I got sober, one of the gifts I got was an opportunity to go back to school and study something I wanted instead of something I could use. And I took a degree in philosophy and theology out of Georgetown. And one of the things I learned in my theology training was that there are two kinds of time. There's something called chronos, chronological time, and that's linear. And I'm out of that now. And then there's something called kairos. And kairos is God's time. And God's time is always now. And it's forever. And I hugged my brother forever. And he died about 6 months later. And I spent many, many hours with him before he died. And he's able to make amends to everybody in the family. And he died with dignity. He died. He was clean. And he died surrounded by people who loved him. And he died praying his rosary in a chair in the middle of the night. He died the way I want to die, sober. And the last thing he said to me was, I don't think I have to drink anymore. And I said, I don't think you do either. You know, those people, I did a lot of damage drunk. I did damage to people I was like a tornado going through life. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had people who meant well but didn't know say things like, Alcoholics Anonymous is a selfish program. That's untrue. I'm a selfish, self-centered person. But Alcoholics Anonymous can free me of that. And I can actually be of service to God and to my fellow man. I can actually go out. And I'll tell you, one of my nine-step stories, and I'll wrap it up. I was a guy, when I came to AA, I was religiously anti-religious. I was so angry, I was just waiting for someone to offend me with this God stuff. And then I'd give them a lecture about AA not being a religion and all the rest of it. You know, and the old-timers would just smile and shake their head and say, you keep coming back and shut up while you're at it, you know, things like that. And I realized that I owed an amends to religious people, because what I really did with religious people was I feared them. Because when I was around them, I looked bad, or I felt worse. And I went looking for a religious person. I went down to a retreat center. And it was an old priest down there, and I went in and sat with him, and we started talking, and I told him why I was there and what I'd been in, and I told him some of my story and where I'd gone and things. And I got about halfway through, and he stopped me, and he picked me up out of the chair, and he put his arms around me. He began to weep, and he said, God sent you here. He said, I've been a priest for 50 years, and he said, I've got a disease that's going to allow me to go home soon. And he said, I was just sitting here, just this day, sitting here asking God, where have I failed? What have I done wrong in serving you? And he said, I realized, he said, my higher power told me to leave the 99 who loved me and agreed with me and go after the one who was lost. And he said, I'm sorry. You had to be out there all alone. And I discovered, I think, the great gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. This isn't a selfish program. And I did a lot of damage in my alcohol. You know, I've been sober now well over two times as long as I drank. And I get to do some good from time to time in the world in which I live. I can leave this place better than I found it. We try to leave our group room cleaner than we find it. And I can leave this world maybe leaving it cleaner And I found that that's the great promise of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not being rich or successful or any of those. That happens to some people it doesn't happen to. It happens to those who can handle it and stay sober. But what can happen to all of us is we can all leave the world better than we found it. It's a great message of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a great freedom of Alcoholics Anonymous. Every morning, I pray that I love my wife more than she loves me, and every night I fail. I'm going to spend the rest of my life trying to do that. And I'll probably spend the rest of my life failing. The more I love my wife, the more she loves me. I'm able to be the kind of married man I wasn't able to be before I knew you. I knew all the things to do. I just didn't have the power. Lack of power was my dilemma. And you're my source of power. You've introduced me to a God who personally loves me very, very much, died for me, gave me everything. And I'd always been taught about him. I have degrees about him. You introduced me to him. The way you live, the way you talk, the way you act, the way you love. You taught me how to be a human being. I owe you everything I have. And I'm so deeply in debt to you. I can only pay the principal, or the interest on the principal. I am so pleased to have been part of this wonderful weekend. It's just terrific. I'm looking forward to hearing George tomorrow. And he'll answer the question, can any good thing come out of West Virginia? And the answer is yes. And I want to thank again Diz and the committee, and I want to thank my friend Laurel for picking me up at the airport. She doesn't know what a great thrill it is for me to see her and a wonderful husband, and to see all of you. And I want to wish my good friends a very happy wedding in June. And it's so great to see Ida and Nate and just all of you, and to meet new guys, and just to wish you the very, very best. And thank you.